Hey guys, I'm here with Alice Hines, the wonderful, brilliant, very intelligent, very talented Alice Hines, who's a writer and is going to read us some of her work, a few articles around the theme of love and dating and other terrifying things, or possibly brilliant, ecstatic, wonderful things. So hi, Alice.
Hey, Bella. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on Food Radio. Very excited to hear from you yourself, your own writing. So
yeah,
I've always followed your work, so I know what it's about. I'm excited the rest of you get to hear it too.
Yeah, it's funny when I write pieces, it's a different experience reading them aloud, but I think that whenever I do read them aloud, it adds a kind of quality to it, because sometimes there's lines that I think are funny that other people don't, or that you might think are funny that I didn't realize were funny, and that's always cool to discover.
Exactly.
So this is a piece that came out, last month, right at the end of September, about an experience I had earlier this year with someone I met on Tinder. So I'll just go ahead. And that was, if you want to read it yourself, that was in the New York Times. So here we go. We met in the West Village, the result of two right swipes on Tinder. I was his first online date, he said, and he was sweetly oblivious to the genre's conventions. 30 minutes in, he wondered if he could make me a list of books that reminded him of me. Of my profile? I asked. My date said he worked as a literary translator for the publishing arm of the New York Review of Books. A lanky 28-year-old with warm brown eyes and long hair tamed by a knit beanie, he seemed to have more prestigious degrees than friends. He'd barely left the house that week, he told me, thanks to a German text on navigational techniques in which an unknown word might turn out to mean a compass made out of a special material produced only by a certain family between 1620 and 1680. It was a flourish on what I've come to believe is one of the more elaborate lies that I've ever been told. The day after our first date, the Tinder translator texted me twice about the weather and twice more about making plans. At the time, I suspected only romance. Awkward, overeager, verbose. I was excited to read his translations. Then the weird thing was I couldn't find any of them. His name didn't appear on the websites of places he had told me he had worked. He wasn't publicly linked to any of the schools he said he had attended. I even composed a few advanced Google searches using conversational crumbs from our date. Site:nyrb.com, site:nybooks.com, quote, linguistic skepticism. Saint Laurent model, menswear. Cabinet magazine, and assistant editor, and Harvard, and Yale. His name was common, so perhaps I was missing something. He had been bashful about the modeling, which was plausible. Who but a polymath, my translator had said he had studied math, computer science, and music, would feel bad for also being nice-looking. At 2 a.m., I learned a lesson in my laptop-lit room. Stalking might not feel like stalking until you're 26 browser tabs deep. I went to bed that night feeling uneasy over my transgression more than the one I begin to imagine he had committed. First dates have always been reveals. As a teenager, I watched adults on 90s television shows proposition strangers in yoga class and meet future spouses while falling in front of taxi cabs. As it turns out, we don't proposition strangers during yoga. We proposition tiny digital image reels of them from our couches or our desks when our bosses aren't looking. Unlike the personal ads and blind date pitches we used to use, these image reels are amazingly lifelike. They're accompanied by troves of information, favorite songs, mutual friends, jokes. Yet still, oddly enough, our dates end up seeming different from what we expect. It's why we look them up. About 75% of millennials do research before a first date, according to Match.com, a dating platform that allows you to filter profiles by eye color, income, and keywords like loves Shiba Inu. I interviewed Helen Fisher, its resident anthropologist, who assured me that researching is natural. In hunting and gathering societies, she said, you'd see someone at the watering hole and already know everything about them. My own watering hole was murky, bottomless, and littered with pop-up tabs asking for my credit card number. In the coming weeks, the missing information about my date was a chasm that, when I tried to fill it, only became more intriguing. We continued to text and went out a couple more times, though I never gained more clarity from him via our interactions. In the meantime, I'd scan the comment sections of YouTube personalities he mentioned following. I nursed theories. Had my date changed his name? Was he secretly an internet troll? Or maybe if I looked hard enough, would I find confirmation that he was just a sweet, accomplished Harvard graduate who happened to not have much of an online presence? Facebook gave me hope. Although I had never sent him a friend request, I easily found his profile and noted our 16 mutual friends, largely from New York literary circles. My roommate appeared to know 9 of the same people as him, including several from Harvard. But one afternoon, I came home to find her agitated. I have something to tell you, she said. My roommate had, without my knowledge, contacted 7 of their mutual Facebook friends. This would have been infuriating if it were not illuminating. All had gotten back to her to say that, in fact, they had no idea who my date was. I have him on restricted profile, which means I definitely never met him in person, says one, who vaguely recalled accepting my date's friend request after seeing their mutual friends. One person my roommate tracked down did know my date, though, and she was willing to speak with me over the phone. She told me he wasn't fluent in German. On our first date, he claimed to be trilingual, having spoken the language along with French and English as a child, that he had only lived, though never studied, in New Haven, so much for the master's degree, and that he had a reputation for embellishing professional details. It's what most people do to make themselves look better, she said. He just does it more. I panicked, which is to say, I gave my research operation a cash injection. Through the National Student Clearinghouse's degree verification service, I put in an official request for my date's Harvard undergraduate records, which cost $22.95. I ran about 80 searches of people with his name under 35 from his home state and their relatives on TLOXP, which is a professional backgrounding database that cost $18.80. I hatched a plan to invite him to a local bar, actually right around here, so that a bartender could later relay the name to me that was listed on his ID. Convincing that bartender took several gin and tonics, which cost $42, but I really needed them anyway. The clearinghouse got back to me. We're unable to verify a degree for this individual, it wrote. Maybe my date had asked that his records be private? The day of the bar sting, which would have been our fourth date, I woke up exhausted and called everything off. I'd like to stay in contact / friends, if that's okay, he texted back. You're really sweet, smart, and fun. I felt a pang. It was a nice note. But I declined, telling him I was getting back together with an ex. I had begun to suspect that all the research in the world would lead me to the same conclusion. My date was mentally ill, and confronting him with what I had found might be risky. But I had another reason for ending things the way I did. I was beginning to notice that my own behavior had become twisted. I was fixated on unraveling the mysteries of this tangled persona. That was a power trip, much like I suspected faking your degree on Tinder must be. In order to end it, I took a page out of his book. I lied. Months later, while writing this article, I found myself sympathizing with my Tinder translator more than I had expected. The strangest part of the research, I came to realize, was how little it had to do with the reasons I liked him in the first place. Resumes, doctored or real, might secure first dates, but they don't have anything to do with second ones, or less. I'd been hooked by our brushed elbows and sweet banter, his rare lack of cynicism. Could those things still be true, even if his identity were false? I wanted to be honest with him about why I ended things, and I hoped he might be honest with me too. So I called him up. And I got my wish, sort of. It was kind of like a performance piece, he said arrogantly at first, confronted with the accusation that he had falsely represented himself. He'd been deliberately cryptic, he said. The goal was to subvert the, quote, shopping-like quality of online dating. I would veil actual work experience and actual institutions I attended, but, you know, with ambiguity, not lies, he said. I'd gotten my facts wrong, he then claimed, rattling off a new list of people and places and accomplishments, very similar but not exactly the same as the credentials he'd mentioned the first time around. One consistency was the New York Review of Books. He was, in fact, currently translating two texts for it, he said. He begged me not to fact check this. It will ruin my career, he said. I'm still not sure what career he means. I wavered, but eventually did email the New York Review of Books, which confirmed that my date had never translated anything for it and that there wasn't anything from him on the docket. Shortly after we hung up, my date called back, this time with a radically different story. The year before meeting me, he said, he experienced a traumatic brain injury from a car accident. I had all of these memories which were mixed up, dreams which would seem very real, he said. I'd hear things that happened to other people and think they happened to me. It's called confabulation. He didn't remember what he did or didn't say to me on our dates, he claimed. I have to suspect this was a ploy to halt further research. He also said he was sorry. On this, at least, I'm inclined to believe him. I mean, feelings aren't possible to fact check. On the surface, the Tinder translator might seem like an anomaly of online dating, the thing we do research specifically to avoid when we're on platforms like Tinder. In fact, he's more like online dating's embodiment taken to the extreme. Most people curate their digital lives to the extent that they border on fiction. We face-tune away our pimples, we lift our heights by an inch, we crop out X's. We don't consider these lies so much as a necessary capitulation. The medium requires the compression of selves into slideshows. And we're hopeful that, when the right person comes along, they'll look past these distortions and see us how we wish to be. Relationships are often built on fantasies that our partners are only their best selves. From the get-go, my date's view of me was a projection. In a half hour, I was a magical incarnation of a list of his favorite books. A small part of me wishes I could be that. It's romantic. But as long as I'm still swiping through image reels, carefully cropped and culled, I'm mostly glad I'm the real me, ready to run a late night background check. That is the end of the story.
Wow. I guess you explained it already in the article, but my first question was like, why didn't you want to be screaming at this guy? Like, why did you lie to me? You're so, like, it's amazing how your kind of trust in situations, and I guess that's a big part of your work, is that you need to have trust in things you find and take them to the next level and take them to the next level. This is going to lead into a whole other series of questions I have for you, which is just like your, how much this is a relation with love and how much it is generally like how we are becoming as people, that lying is becoming or adjusting the truth is becoming easier. And it's not just in dating, it's also in job applications. It's in, you know, just also when you meet someone at a bar, you think, oh, it's so easy to do in a photo. I can do it in a conversation.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think when I first started writing this article, I made a lot of the same connections you're making about how the internet seemed to be almost the culprit, because mm-hmm. it allows you to kind of fabricate this identity mm-hmm. through all of these digital platforms, which don't have a lot of checks and balances, which you alluded to the similarity to journalism in general, which is my job. I'm a journalist, and that has also caused a lot of problems within the industry of journalism, right? Sort of like mm-hmm. the difficulty of fact-checking information that is spreading on the internet. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's definitely something that I was thinking about when I was writing this. But at the same time, the funny thing about it is that I actually, the more I thought about this guy, the more I realized that I think people like him who who are lying for reasons that I still don't really totally understand, mm-hmm. Have always existed, and that the internet is a tool for them, but it is also a tool for finding the truth and exposing right. them. Because if I had met him in a bar, let's say in 1980, mm-hmm. I'm 30 years old, so that wouldn't have happened, yeah. but just say, I wouldn't have been able to as easily check his lies as I yeah. was through my research.
Do you think that his lies would have been less elaborate had the internet not been there? And it being a little bit, I don't know whether it's easier to lie. I mean, I guess it's just as easy to have the words cross your lips than to type it on a profile. But
yeah,
I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that maybe encounters were a little bit more local and people's lives were a little bit more centered to a certain neighborhood and a certain place. And even if you're in a big city, and maybe those kind of different breadths of people with breadths of experiences wouldn't have come up and wouldn't have found their ways into your own lives to lie about.
I think that's absolutely the argument that Helen Fisher, who is the anthropologist who works for Match.com, mm-hmm. That was her argument, right? Mm-hmm. So basically the sort of, I guess, disconnection of modern life where it's amazing how many new people we encounter on a day-to-day basis, but it's mm-hmm. true that these like local communities that used to be the center of our social worlds and the way that we would build relationships, in which people did just automatically know a lot more about everyone because maybe you lived in an enclave where that's who you were meeting. I mean, I do think that it would have been more difficult to lie, but at the same time, I almost feel like the elaborateness of this person's lies, this person who I was going on these dates with, I almost think it was compulsive.
Yeah, like it sounds a lot like
exactly.
It.
It's like because the lie is also so specific. It's almost that it's strange to me because if you were really like just even having it be a little less elaborate would have made it more difficult to fact check because, you know, oh, okay, freelance, even if he's a freelance translator, not really saying yeah. where he works for, but blah, 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 blah. Like mm-hmm. I probably would have been fine with it and not like right. been even able to look into it that much. Yeah. But I do also think that I was in a funny position writing the story because of what I do for work. Mm-hmm. And then what my position is just as a person who was on these apps looking for, yeah. looking to meet someone. Because I think that it was more, I was quicker to sort of fall into the, oh, well, I can always find everything about anyone because I know about these methods and right. they are accessible to me in my work life. So let me look into him. And I mean, the crazy thing is actually, so I haven't said this in publicly yet, but some people reached out to me after I wrote that story who I didn't name him in the story, but a couple people recognized him who had also dated
really?
Him.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, and so that was really interesting. And I spoke with some of them and it was troubling. I feel like,
because at that point you become almost responsible for something or like clarifying something that happened to them, and so it like crosses territory from yeah. journalist to psychologist.
Yeah, it definitely. Therapist. Well, that boundary is often blurry.
Is often, yeah.
But yeah, it was strange. But then, yeah, I don't know, and I think that these were I don't know these young women. In our conversations, they seemed very, very smart and interesting and savvy. But mm-hmm. I do think that it's strange. And then that's another thing that I was engaging with in this article, like the feeling of guilt for how suspicious I was about this person.
Right.
And you said that I come off as trusting in the article, which is very interesting. I think my roommate, who is a small character in the story, but is maybe even a larger character in how all of this played out, because, you know, she was the one who initially figured out that he was lying about things.
Yeah.
yeah.
So if she hadn't have said anything, you would have, on the basis of those mutual friends on Facebook, you would have gone on another set of dates.
Yes, I mean, I was looking anyway because I was suspicious too because none of the translations were coming up.
Yeah.
But she was, I mean, she was even more suspicious than me and I think thought that I was too trusting as well.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, but the funny thing is I found myself not trusting enough. I felt like I was being overly suspicious about this person and that it's somehow doing this research and being suspicious is unromantic.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. How much, how, this is a little bit of a tangent, but how important is it to your writing to stay somewhat close to yourself, candid and open about your personal stories every now and again? And if you, I mean, I know that there are certain other moments where you're writing about something that you haven't had a personal experience in, but not every writer gives that part up of themselves. Some of them, you know, you'll never have a kind of presence in it. What is that like part of who you are as a writer, that you'll always do that? Is that a, you know, a first for you? How did that feel? That, I mean, I was nervous speaking on the radio to, you know, my three listeners last week, and you know that everybody buys the New York Times.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had some anxiety about that before the publication of the article, and it's to answer your question, I have over the course of my my life as a writer written about my own experiences in sort of a more memoir style, which is what this piece was, from time to time. But it isn't actually the style that I take usually.
No.
I would say most of the time, it is of course always a personal interest, mm-hmm. which is sparked in a topic that makes me want to look into it.
Yeah.
But for the most part, my stories are, I'm not a character in them if I don't need to be, because mm-hmm. I feel that you only have a certain amount of time. You're taking up people's attention. I usually feel that the story of whomever I'm interviewing is probably the most interesting to a stranger.
Right.
So I don't actually write in the first person very often.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I brought a collection of stories that I was thinking of reading today, which we'll hopefully get to some of during the course of the hour. And yeah, look, thinking about them, some of them, yeah, so they're a mix,
mm-hmm.
But it's, yeah, it's, it can be hard, but I also think it can be a weird way of processing your strange experiences that happened to you.
Yeah.
For example, with this story, I feel like it was a bit shocking and disturbing to me at first, and through the process of writing about it, it's kind of helped me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you... And feel free to ignore the question, but are you back on Tinder? Do you feel comfortable being back on like social network or so, like media based?
Yeah, it's a good question. I didn't immediately like delete Tinder after this experience. Mm-hmm. I feel like I maybe went on out on a couple more dates, but to be honest, I haven't been using it lately, and I do feel like it's not even that. I mean, what are the chances of finding another person like that? I mean, that seems very unlikely to happen twice.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it did turn me off to it, because it just felt like it was sort of this like very like emotionally trying thing that I didn't have a lot of control of, and that this process of evaluating people and kind of testing people, and not just when they come into your life and it feels organic, but actually like on a regular and active basis, just it does feel a little trying. So I'm not on them right now.
We can grab a drink and see what the gin and tonic bartender has to offer in terms of suggestions.
No, he was nice.
Sounds
pretty nice. Yeah.
So maybe let's dip in, if you're up for it, into another article. Maybe you want to.
Yeah, let's do it. Let me just pull them up.
And I don't know if you're. I mean, we have a hotline. If anybody wants to call in and speak to Alice.
Yes.
The number is 646-476-5075. You can also DM us at food_office hours on Instagram. If you have any requests, any questions, anybody had a horrible dating experience, anybody wants to talk about writing, and so, I'll leave Alistair to read us something else.
Yeah, so I think, so I have a couple. Maybe let's do one, that is, have another one about the dating app Raya, but let's maybe save that one for a bit later and sure. do one that is about, that is actually about catcalling. So this, yeah. So this is a piece I wrote, in 2014 for Gawker, RIP, loved Gawker. And this was a great piece edited by a great editor, Leah Finnegan. I'll just get started on it. It's called Why I Talk to Men Who Catcall Me.
Wow.
So I learned French in bars getting hit on by weird men. Also, in subway cars and public parks, in internet cafes looking for apartments, and shopping for cheap kitchenware at outdoor flea markets. At first, I didn't understand anything they were saying to me, but eventually I picked up patterns. Ça va? What's up? Was innocuous. Usually fine to ask the person for directions or even a metro ticket. Vous êtes charmante. You're charming. Was best ignored. Anything resembling tu sus, not to be confused with Marché aux Puces, a landmark near my apartment, meant I should walk away as fast as possible. When I moved to Paris, I had a hunch that not knowing anyone would force me into the kinds of awkward situations where I would naturally pick up the language. I was right. But I didn't predict it would turn my day-to-day existence into something like that viral video where the woman is walking around New York getting catcalled, except for not edited together for dramatic effect. My first day in the city, I actually spent 10 hours walking around different neighborhoods with two suitcases and only the vaguest of plans. The next few months were similar until I could build the components of a private life, jobs, friends, an apartment. I spent a huge portion of my existence in public and consequently getting hit on by men in a language I could barely understand. My life prior had always been comfortable and safe, and strangely, the experience was weirdly thrilling. When I showed up, I was riding an 18-year-old's adrenaline high of having just told her horrified parents she was buying a one-way ticket to a foreign country. My average day looked a lot like this. Hand out a resume to a tourist hellhole of a restaurant who might not care that I only spoke English, scurry to a babysitting gig, and drag my suitcase to a Craigslist sublet. At night, I went to parties alone that I read about on the internet. If I wanted to talk to anyone, I chose between random strangers, almost always men, who approached me and were typically willing to speak to me despite the fact that I could barely participate in conversations. These interactions started, for the most part, as standard street harassment fare. Sexual invitations couched in various degree of creativity and politeness. Sometimes they were worse. Insults, verbal abuse, once a groping. But occasionally, they turned out to be interesting. Two men who introduced themselves with a vous êtes charmante showed me how to play a didgeridoo months later. Apologies for the pronunciation on that, guys. I learned about the only store in Paris that sold peanut butter, a sorely missed item, from a dude who insisted on badgering me about my bread and cheese lunch that I ate on a park bench. None of these interactions turned into lasting friendships, but that doesn't mean they weren't useful or thought-provoking. Today, now living in New York City, I still talk to men on the street, and I still find the experience interesting. When one of them says, hey, I often say, hey, back, before I've determined whether or not the greeting has a sexual undercurrent. That doesn't mean I'm nice to everyone, or that I never respond with silence or fuck off. It does mean that I'll occasionally find myself talking on the subway with a guy sitting next to me while a female friend watches on uncomfortably. Or when a construction worker asks me how my day is going, answer and ask them the same question, because I want to know. In Paris, I often talk to strange men because it was the only way to break out of linguistic and social isolation. Now I do it because I'm curious. I'm not going to learn a new language, but I might get a window into another person's thoughts. And if they're not good thoughts, I can walk away. What's fucked up about the public dialogue about street harassment is that for many women, it's one directional. Today in New York, I'm still not always comfortable initiating conversations with men, even if I might take the chance of responding to them. Meanwhile, people are hardly ever engaging each other in random conversation, one of the more overlooked ramifications of a culture of street harassment. As a result, we're obligated to assume, based on past experiences, that the majority of conversations we have with strangers, whether they turn out to be enlightening or creepy, start because someone viewed us as sexual objects. For many women, that's a good enough reason to label any uninitiated public comments from someone who appears to be a man, including ambiguous hellos, as harassment, and call for their annihilation. It's a murky area to navigate. It's unfair for women to bear the burden of evaluating any comment or gesture from a man for potential risk, a feat of mental calculation that's time-consuming and anxiety-inducing. We shouldn't be obliged to do this every time we walk down the street. But I find that doing it can be worthwhile. Sometimes it's empowering. For much of history, women were excluded from engaging in dialogue from public spaces. When I choose to say hey back, I'm claiming my right to public speech as well as to explore unknown experiences. In a way, it's a little like deciding to move to Paris on a whim. And like that choice, it can sometimes get you into trouble. But what's especially awesome about saying hey back is that, unlike moving to Paris, when things go badly, you can say, fuck off, and walk away. That feels pretty empowering, too. That's it. Yeah, sorry all my loved ones are about negative experiences,
no,
guys.
That
I love love.
You know you do. One thing, and this is written in 2014, right?
Yeah, it's interesting how it aged. I was thinking about
What do you feel about... This is a question without a single... judgment behind it, just in case anybody thought that. But what do you feel like post whatever's been going on, the year of the woman, Me Too, the fact that women are starting to maybe feel, whether it's the right thing, I don't know, or the right way to tackle this, but be, you know, really forcefully and openly angry about people that speak to them on the street? Or
yeah, it's interesting. Well, one funny thing is, so it was 2006 when I moved to Paris, like, mm-hmm. as an 18-year-old without knowing anybody. Uh-huh. And this summer, actually, they passed a law in France that is that is fining catcalling and any type of, like, street harassment with, like, if you report it to a police officer or a police officer witnesses it, you can get fined. I want to say up to 700 euros.
Is that much?
It can be as low as, like, 70 euros. It depends on the type of harassment.
That's the figure that I have.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a range depending on the type of harassment, which... So I'm actually very interested to know, like, how much has changed for people there. I think one interesting part of this dynamic is that, and the argument against a penalty like that for street harassment is that it disproportionately penalizes people who are already underprivileged. So basically, if somebody is saying a sexist comment to you mm-hmm. in a bar, maybe it's a nice bar, they're not going to get any penalty for street harassment. So only public spaces are the place where this misogynistic comments are penalized, which impacts people who don't have access to private spaces. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's something there. And I feel like that's a really sort of, like, complicated thing about, like, the street harassment conversation. But I guess, like, that's also one of the reasons why, in spite of everything, I actually still feel like I agree with the argument I made in that article, which was very much more of, like, an opinionated mm-hmm. opinion article. Which is that I think one way to kind of subvert that dynamic is to just talk to people, and it doesn't actually necessarily have to be about sort of, like, a maybe something seemed like a sexist comment, but was it actually? Well, you're never gonna know unless you talk back to them, and if you do know, you can just walk away. And I mean, the other thing, like, if the problem is sexual objectification, then you are subverting that in a way by trying to engage with somebody at someone as a speaker, yeah. right? And not just as an object. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have something to say and maybe you're curious about them too.
Right.
So I think that, that there's a, the power of conversation is real. And I like, I still do really like the idea of encouraging dialogue in public spaces. Mm-hmm. But yeah, another, just to be totally frank, another thing that I'm thinking about with this article is just like, I think personally, and this is, I guess, a part of my own biases. I mean, I'm today in 2018 thinking a lot more about people who maybe are have non-binary gender presentations mm-hmm. and how, like, how I guess these assumptions about how, like, what these sort of sexual comments might impact them on the street. And I feel like one limitation of the article, actually looking back, is the, like, I guess, sort of laser focus on this, like male-female dynamic, which I feel like is like definitely revealing, but only kind of one part of what's really going on when we are mm-hmm. kind of like looking at people on the street and making assumptions about them. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think it's, that's another thing I think about. And I don't, that's not, I don't, I know that's kind of open-ended. I don't have a conclusion about it, but it is one way in which my thinking has changed since I wrote that article.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, I do think that, I mean, it's always difficult to distinguish. I feel like you can tell when someone is catcalling just for the sake of saying something because there's a group of, you know, sometimes guys behind them that are cheering them on. They'll do it to every woman that walks by, and it's not a conversation initiator and somebody that's maybe clumsy and says, you know, and thinks, I mean, sorry for the generalization, but especially in Paris, that's like, what some men do to right. initiate a conversation. Actually, if you dig a little further, they'll kind of peel off that kind of awkward layer.
Yeah, for sure.
So I don't know whether that means there should be these rules. I'm generally scared, a little bit scared about censoring too much and aggressing too much. As long as we have the means to also teach each other that certain things are out of bounds. And I do think that words can feel the same as if somebody touched you, which is an uncomfortable and uninvited thing sometimes.
But yeah, it can be very, yeah, the like, I guess the distance between those things is very weird. I mean, I guess it's strange. This experience in Paris was very, like, formative for me. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, continues to shape things, like, my suspicion about people that I yeah. meet on dating apps. Like, this happened at a time which was very, like, formative for me. And yeah. I guess I feel like I'm still, like, working past some of whatever those assumptions are that I made in the article. It's crazy.
How many... I mean, this is a silly question, but how many ideas for articles, important parts of articles or writing for you have come out of random conversations with people?
Oh, well, I think a lot of them. yeah, I mean, I think that that's really important. I get a lot of ideas from random conversations with people, and it's not the only place I get ideas. Like, I would say random conversations with people for sure. And just like, yeah, I mean, different places. Like for a while I worked around here in this neighborhood. I was going to work like on the corner of Broadway and Walker every day when I had this full-time job in the fashion industry. And I would walk past the West African handbag vendors like that are by the old bank building that was a pharmacy for a while every day. Mm-hmm. And I would see the ways that their schedule would kind of be different at different points in the day. I started recognizing some of them. Mm-hmm. I started having conversations with them, and I ended up spending a lot of time with them, and the product of which was an article I wrote for the Village Voice a couple years ago. And that was just purely because of like regular things that mm-hmm. I saw in my day-to-day life. And I think that part of that, what the thing that interested me about that article was, again, this like idea of interaction in public space, because some of these men, it's almost all men, would yeah, I mean, they spent their entire day like on the street in New York City, kind of just like witnessing the ebbs and flows and like having these tiny conversations with people and doing that for years and years. And that was just such an interesting perspective. Yeah. And I wish we could all do more of that, which is why I talk to catcallers. Yeah, anyway.
I mean, to tie it in also into the kind of larger theme that's going on at Food Radio, that's one of the reasons I was so happy that you were coming in, because to me, and please interrupt me and correct me if that's not the case, but you are for me the kind of model freelancer. And freelancing, I had always guessed, was freelancing, I'd always guessed was important for you so that you could work for lots of different people, different kinds of publications, move around when you wanted to move around, but without the responsibility of having, say, your own business and your own, you know, people working for you. This is, again, this is an assumption, but that was, for me, what I was like, freelancing and Alice, that makes so much sense for those reasons, and it was an empowering thing for you.
Yeah, I think, like, it's strange because I've been freelance for maybe 3 or 4 years, and I first quit that full-time job because first of all, I missed writing, and even though I love fashion too, so I missed writing, and I thought that I wanted to explore it, and that the best way to kind of figure out what I wanted to write about was to freelance and write about lots of different things and kind of explore and try to find a beat of sorts, beat in journalism being an area of focus, politics, business, technology, things like that. And so then the years kind of passed and I never really found a beat. And I decided that I was kind of okay with that.
Yeah.
it's funny. So when you asked me to do this radio show that we're doing right now, I was kind of thinking, I don't want it to just be all over the place, but then I realized that there are themes over the years.
Yeah.
There are things that I keep returning to over and over as topics of interest. And so, that's one of the things I really love about freelancing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's definitely a hustle, and that for me makes me productive. Like, okay, thinking about how February will look financially, like thinking pretty far in the future.
Right.
Huh, okay, maybe you gotta do X, Y, and Z right now, you know? And kind of like that to me is motivating. And then don't mess with something that's working. So keep doing it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I guess maybe also this isn't an article. I don't know if that was, I think you suggested it, an article that you wrote, I believe, for the Times, not long after the Me Too movement broke out, about the dominatrix and giving tips on how to maybe avoid sexual harassment at work, maybe to give some of our listeners some tools if they don't want to receive that catcall.
Totally. Well, you know what? If you want tools, you should look up this woman who, I'll read that story and you will see what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And I do give some examples of techniques of hers that I observed. But I think she's really interesting and has sort of developed this program in which she uses kind of like the psychology of BDSM and these kind of power dynamics that she learned about as a professional dominatrix and teaches them to people for use in everyday life. And I think actually this article also is, I think, focused on quote men, quote women,
right?
Because that was the way she was framing the program.
Yeah.
It was as a response to Me Too,
right?
And as a way to basically, like, she was giving these tools to people who practically seemed to need them.
Yes.
But I do think one of the really interesting things about this story I'm going to read is that the stuff that she's talking about, this dominatrix actually doesn't really, it's not, it really weirdly has almost nothing to do with gender. Mm-hmm. Like it applies to gender in a certain way as it would be in society, as it exists in society and in the workplace. But like the psychology and the rhetorical tools she's talking about, are apply to anyone.
Yeah, and also lots of different situations. I mean, bullying or kind of anything that you're intimidated by. If you're standing in a bar and somebody asks you something you're not, you know, you don't want to, then you can apply these tricks. I mean, I think that.
Yeah, well,
I've definitely used them. So
use them, cool. Yeah, I think about this all the time still. Yeah. So yeah, let's read that one. Okay, so this was published in January of this year, and this was actually my first article for the New York Times. So you like breaking rules, do you? Kasia Urbaniak said to the bald man seated before her. Or do you like getting in trouble? That's pretty greedy of you to come in here and do something right away to warrant punishment. I haven't even had a chance to assess what kind of punishment you need. She paced across the bright stage in platform leather boots. An audience of 130 professional women, bankers, marketing directors, were observing this demonstration in the parquet-floored ballroom of a rented Midtown Manhattan co-working space. They took careful notes and, when prompted, shot their hands in the air to volunteer to role play on stage. Ms. Urbaniak, 39, worked as a dominatrix for 17 years, independently and in dungeons in New York City. Now, in something she calls the Academy, she teaches women what she has learned about men. In a moment of cultural reckoning around gender and harassment, the Academy is one of the new unconventional entities, including anonymous spreadsheets and Hollywood-run legal defense funds, emerging to fight discrimination and bias. So the point is not her leather riding crop. Her mission is teaching women how to employ a dominatrix's rhetorical tools in any scenario where there's a power imbalance, whether or not it's about sex. The scenarios happen everywhere. Sometimes it's in an office elevator. I worked for 9 months negotiating a multi-million dollar contract, said Hannah Kubiak, 46, a business development director for an aerospace company. And the day we were going to close the deal, my boss suggested I look into lunch arrangements while he and his boss signed. Other times it's at a cocktail party. A guy asks, "Where are you from?" said Sophia Lee, a consultant and former Vogue editor. People who are racially ambiguous know that's the worst question. Sometimes it's on a date. I lost track of how many times I was assaulted, said Terry DeMio, 70, a coach and former lawyer. My nose were wobbly. These were clients of Ms. Urbaniak's. Do you see the pattern, she asked from the stage, of moments like this? When faced with an uncomfortable question, there's a moment of speechlessness, of neuromuscular lockdown in women. Urbaniak discovered, back when she began training dominatrixes, a fix. Instead of answering or refusing to answer the question, ask someone a question back about why he asked his question in the first place. When he responds, dig in with more probing. Students practice the technique. Ms. Urbaniak and a cadre of male volunteers facilitated, playing the parts of nosy date or film executive who has lost his bathrobe strap. The name of the workshop was Cornering Harvey. He asks, "Do your children all have the same father?" She asks, "Are you fantasizing about me having sex with multiple men?" He asks, "Can we review your presentation in my hotel room?" She asks, "Where did you get that shirt?" Comebacks can't even be off topic or pointed. They can be sweet or biting. Testing the reaction they provoke is informative and playful. He's on the spot, and you regain your footing, Ms. Urbaniak said. Not everyone catches on right away. "I don't know what my uncomfortable question is," one student asked. "Every time I take your class, Do you feel embarrassed that you freeze all the time? Ms. Urbaniak said. Yeah, the student said. No, don't answer. See? The student had missed her cue. The Academy was founded in 2014 by Ms. Urbaniak, who's a graduate of Bard College, and her creative partner, Ruben Flores, formerly of NYC Medics. Their courses draw on BDSM, Taoist martial arts, Cesar Millan's books on dog training, and the hostage and border checkpoint negotiations of international NGOs. It's quite unlike corporate sexual harassment training, which typically consists of video or PowerPoint presentations filled with warnings about liability and potential business costs. Some studies have shown that these trainings aren't particularly effective. In a 2016 report, the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission's Harassment Task Force recommended, among other changes, interactive trainings in which employees role-play misconduct. U.S. companies spent $15 to $40 per employee on sexual harassment training, according to Michael Johnson of the Clear Law Institute, which creates programs for HR departments. Advanced Power with Men, Kasia Urbaniak's forthcoming weekend-long workshop, is sold out at $2,200 a spot. Another course, Foundations of Power, costs $8,500 for 3 in-person weekends and an online component. Harassment is a tip of the iceberg for long-term students who look to Ms. Urbaniak for a wide range of things, including fixing marriages, reading body language, and resetting careers. It's a fantastic idea. This should be in a damn high school, says Sue Storm, a Toronto-based fetish therapist and pro-dom, that's industry shorthand for professional dominatrix, with no connection to the Academy. But I'd love to see it cheaper. She said that was because you're trying to help the average women, not men who will pay anything, quote, for their sexual fantasies. Cornering Harvey is the Academy's largest and most affordable class yet, $45 for 3 hours, with a sliding scale for anyone who can't pay full price. Ms. Urbaniak is also developing an online version of the workshop, as well as live trainings for organizations, and that online version is live currently. I don't know that we've ever had anything happen in history where what's on the forefront of culture was so intimate, personal, and relational, she told her audience. It's a huge opportunity. The Academy draws from dominatrix's psychological rather than physical tools. Those include the physical ones, cuffs, paddles, blindfolds, and feathers, if rarely actual sex. Political applications of BDSM make sense when you consider the gender roles that trap women in submissive societal positions are the same ones that lock men in sexually dominant ones, which lead men to dominatrixes to escape them, says Ms. Storm. Women are socialized to be submissive. Men think they have to be some kind of alpha male. Several attendees were hesitant to give their names for this article, fearing friends and colleagues' reactions. If they caught wind, I did a class with a dominatrix, I'd be a laughingstock, said one 39-year-old investment bank vice president. Her colleagues don't know that she's been using the techniques at work. In Academy lexicon, the word you is dominant and the word I is submissive. Neither is inherently superior. If I'm in control of you, my attention is outward, so precisely fixed on you that I almost forget I exist, Ms. Urbaniak told the audience. When you're in the submissive role, your attention is focused inward on yourself and your own feelings. Dominant and submissive are rhetorical and energetic states, per Urbaniak, and can be unmoored from the social hierarchies that empower some. It's a post-gender outlook with as much in common as with theories of performativity as women's empowerment programs like Lean In, which focus on elite communities as a way to tap female power. Demographically, though, the Academy is similar to those peers. The participants I spoke with said most of students are white and are straight and cisgender. Straight and cisgender. 25% are non-white, according to the company, although the school is open to anyone who identifies as female. At Cornering Harvey, the majority of attendees had heard about the workshop through the School of Womanly Arts. In that school's mastery course, which costs around $5,000, participants call each other sister goddesses and examine their vaginas with mirrors. Many Academy students have more economic advantages than other women, which may be a root, may be the root of their faith that resetting power dynamics on an individual level could spur widespread social change. Imagine if someone had said this to Louis C.K., Mr. Boniak told the nodding group, after a student met the question, "Can I masturbate in front of you?" with a probing zinger question of her own. If a woman had been able to reach him, how might that have changed things? It's optimistic. As the Louis C.K. news broke, a 2001 clip from his show surfaced in which an earnest young blonde asks him a question. "Have you ever tried not masturbating?" He responds, "Later I'm going to masturbate and I'm going to think of you and there's nothing you can do about it." For Ms. Kubiak, the aerospace business developer, the Academy's potential lies beyond reforming men. Perceiving and fluidly shifting between dominant and submissive roles improves our communication as a species, she said. If Elon Musk enables transport to Mars and humans are traveling light years in small places, spaces to other planets, our ability to clearly live and receive requests and to read and receive a room will be even more important than it is terrestrially, she says. For now, Ms. Kubiak is exploring the nuances of dominance and submission at Starbucks. One day, I might say, "I really feel like a white chocolate mocha." The next, "You're going to make me a cappuccino with extra foam, super dry." Practice makes perfect. "I'd really like to be in the room," Ms. Kubiak told his boss when he asked her to arrange lunch instead of being present for the signing of the deal she had negotiated. "If she could do it over, I'd nail him with a bunch of questions," she said. That's it.
Do you have any, maybe you don't want to give that away, but any favorite answering questions to like throw people off?
You know what? I think the thing is, it's really different on the scenario, really different from the scenario. But I weirdly think that, and actually I talked about this with Kaja, who's the woman who is the focus of my story, who's teaching these classes, mm-hmm. about that catcalling article. And it's kind of a similar technique. It mm-hmm. when somebody is coming to you with something that is throwing you off, and you need to take the time to kind of figure it out, and you are almost frozen, mm-hmm. unsure of what to say, what she says, and kind of it makes sense with what I was also intuitively trying to do, which is reset the dynamic and ask them something back that surprises them.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, it can get you in a better place and actually restructure mm-hmm. social dynamics. So I think that the technique is really effective. I think that also maybe one thing that did come across in my article, which I also think, is that they were the people who are doing this program have very big dreams for what mm-hmm. they think it will accomplish.
Right.
And while I think that it's a great technique, and I think anyone who has used it is seeing its effect, whether it might change the world or like right. how like what the extent of it is, I think is still like a question that will need to be answered.
Yeah, it's not something that everybody's comfortable with,
right?
Too. Or I find it hard to think of things on the spot if somebody surprises me or...
Totally. That's exactly right. And what...
I can always think of 50 brilliant things to say like an hour too late, but...
Well, I think that that's the point, though, is that it doesn't have to be... it doesn't have to be brilliant, because even it can just be someone is asking you a question that makes you uncomfortable, like... Oh, like it could even be like for me, even like you're asking me why, like we're talking about my freelance career, right? If I'm in a bad mood and don't really feel like talking about it mm-hmm. and someone is asking me like, what publications are you writing for as a freelancer? Like, what are your like three latest stories? Mm-hmm. Like all of these like kind of probing questions about my job in a way that is making me feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I could answer them and then feel uncomfortable, or I could flip it back on them and say, oh, well, like what kind of stories have you been interested in reading? Because like, maybe that would help me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like basically just put them on the spot rather than you be on the spot.
Right.
So it doesn't actually matter what the content of the question is so much as just the act, like the rhetorical act of you mm-hmm. being the one that asks it and them thinking about it.
Right.
So like even it can be anything. So mm-hmm. I think like that
like realizing that made me feel a lot more comfortable with it. And then as you saw in the story, like they were actually like role playing and trying to like train in this method. So there was the woman who was saying that exactly what you said. I can't ever think of a question. Right? Yeah. I can never think of a question. Right. And so Kaja is kind of digs in and is like, oh, like, is that because, like, are you embarrassed? Like, do you feel uncomfortable speaking in public? And the woman's like, yeah. And that's not what she was supposed to do. She should have said, why do you like asking people uncomfortable questions? She should have fired back. Does that make sense with a question
that,
of her own?
That makes sense. But still, I think, like, that takes a little bit of guts to do that, especially because a lot of the time you need these kind of tools and scenarios where you are in a lesser position, you think you are.
Right, totally.
Right.
So that's why you should pay $8,500 to become a sister goddess? No, that's a different program.
Oh, right,
but
sorry.
To take the fundamentals of power training course. I mean, you don't have to do that. And certainly they're not saying that's the only way to find out. But certainly people are paying that in order to go very deep into this practice. So there's lots of different ways that you can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I found it a little bit easier getting a little older. Apparently, women are a lot more confident in their late 20s than they are in their early, which is
that true?
A common thing. Yeah, I read, I don't remember where it was, but I read somewhere that at 29 is when women are at their most confident.
That's interesting.
I think it's like a combination of, like, I don't know, I guess like accepting and knowing what you are, what you look like, what your reactions and your actions are, what you're good at, what you're bad at. And then also like not giving as much of a crap about things. Not in general, but like things that were, I don't know, maybe super important for you before. I know that I care less about what people think of me. That has always been a very important thing for me. And a combination with like having a bit of experience and knowing what I need to ask for. Like if something's missing, I should ask for it. And whether it's, you know, an employer that isn't giving it to me, whether it's a lover or partner that isn't giving it, or a friend that isn't giving it to me, I can recognize certain patterns and I can ask things and say, hey, you know, in order to keep things balanced, I need a bit more of this, or what do you need from me?
Yeah, because it never hurts to ask. The worst thing is just holding it in and marinating. Right. No, that's what she's saying too. I completely agree with that. I don't know if it gets, I hope it gets easier. I mean, like, I wish that like these dynamics were, I guess, like more fluid in general, and that I hadn't been like I said earlier. So I guess like had this such formative experience of being sort of like the object of all of this like weird, I guess, I don't know how to classify it, but all of the street harassment, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I don't know. I guess like as I get older, I do feel like I am more comfortable responding to things that are coming to me and just more comfortable in general. But I also just wish that shit would all go away.
Yeah.
Like,
true.
Let's make that
the
happen.
Things would get easier.
Yeah, just like make it go away. It's like, we don't know. It's like, cause even the act of like feeling good about responding to that, or I'm really good at this now, like I can deal with uncomfortable questions, like I took this course, I wrote this article, like I can deal with an uncomfortable question, like I can talk to catcallers, like I can do anything, like I can investigate this online date, like all of that, you know what I mean? Like there's like, okay, yeah, I feel like, I guess like maybe a theme that I didn't even realize of all of these articles that I read is like, okay, so like these are tools through which like you can feel empowered, right? Yeah. Like, and empowerment is a word that I kind of hate, that has like lost a lot of its meaning, but like the root of it is power, which is real, right? I mean, so yeah, so like through all these things you can feel empowered, but then even just the labor of utilizing these tools and polishing them and sharpening them and making them fit into your life is something that is very, even that I feel like I have problems with. And maybe that's like the problem. Maybe that's the question that I might explore like going forward. Like, and maybe that's a question for my 30s. I don't know.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that, in terms of confidence, that's what I mean. I don't think I'll ever be the kind of person that will be very snappy and quick. And no matter how much training or brilliant people I surround myself with that are very good at doing that, I don't think that'll ever be something that's natural to me or super sharpened for me. But I at least, not forgive myself, but I don't sit with it as long or after the situation happens. Like,
right.
I really think, great, when it does. And when it doesn't, I think, you know, whenever I go into the next situation, I'll be prepared, or I won't let it brew and sit for as long. But
yeah, well, that's really important too. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, because ultimately, like, all of these power dynamics that we're talking about today, like, are an ever-present thing in society, and they, like, are things that we will, I mean they can bring happiness as well, like, mm-hmm. I mean, they can bring, yeah, I think that they're not always, like, these dynamics are, like, connected to things that can also, like, bring pleasure and joy, yeah, and, like, sparks in life that are interesting, right? But then, yeah, like, I don't know. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah. So I've taken you longer than I promised that I would, but I would like to at least paint a little bigger of a picture about you before you go,
yeah,
and
sure,
all the things that you're involved in, and talk maybe about Vestoy a little bit. So maybe you can give us a little bit of a,
what
is Alice up to these days?
Yeah, so I mean,
I know that's a question that can.
Right, so I'm still, so I'm basically just, I'm writing lots of articles. I have a few in the works right now that I think will be really interesting. One I've been spending a lot of time on is about the yoga industry. So tune in for that one. I didn't really realize yoga was such an industry, but in fact it is. And there's some interesting and a little bit fishy things happening in it.
Yeah, I've had my own experiences with that, my God.
Right. Okay. I will hear about those at some point. I'm working on that. And so I'm constantly coming up with ideas, and also people are assigning me ideas. Mm-hmm. So it's a mix of editors who I have relationships with coming to me and saying, oh, hey, would you like to do this article? And then me coming up with ideas and going out to editors. That is sort of the how it falls out. And I'm also, I also am doing, so we talked a lot about, I guess, like, love and sexuality and gender today, but I also, as I mentioned before, I used to work in the fashion industry, and mm-hmm. I still think fashion is a super fascinating topic, and I write about it all the time. That's another kind of, like, overarching theme over the years. One project that I've been so lucky to be invested in, which Bella mentioned earlier, is a fashion magazine called Vestoy. It is an online platform and an annual print journal, which is text-based, not text-only, but mm-hmm. When you are flipping through it or when you are reading an article on the online platform, they're going to be mostly long-form articles, which is, I think, the unique in fashion, yeah, magazines. I think that there's actually no other fashion magazine that's the case for.
Yeah.
It's also ad-free journal, yeah, so unlike also every other fashion magazine,
yeah,
we have funding from an academic source, so it's a totally independent fashion magazine. Mm-hmm. And so that is a project that I was working as an online editor for 2 years. I recently stepped down as online editor, but I'm staying on as a contributor, and has been just an amazing community of people that I've gotten in touch with. It's mm-hmm. sort of like, I feel like Vestoy is a magnet for, like, people who have the smartest, weirdest ideas about fashion, including some people that you introduced me to, Bella.
Mm-hmm.
You connected me to our mutual friend, the writer Mary Wang,
Wonderful Mary Wang.
Yeah, exactly. Shout out, who's a writer, wrote a beautiful memoir piece that I think was in Longreads recently. That was awesome.
Right.
Anyway, tangent.
We should get her on here.
Maybe yeah, we
you
should
can
get
come
her
back and we can both speak
totally,
to her.
Totally, yeah, that would be good. So Vestoy is sort of like a magnet for all of these amazing currents in fashion that I think get left out of the commercial fashion conversation. And I have been, one of the themes that I've written about a lot for Vestoy is counterfeits. So I mentioned the article I wrote about for the Village Voice about about the West African handbag vendors on Canal Street, which, fun fact, west of Broadway is West African, east of Broadway is East Asian. So there's actually like a pretty like clear divide. They work together, but that's how the geography is laid out, FYI.
Oh, great.
And so, yeah, I mean, so that story, I was very interested in sort of like the counterfeits that are being sold, and also the lives of people who are selling them, which mm-hmm. is a topic that I continue to explore at Vestoy. In pieces that, for example, a piece I wrote for them that was in the current issue, print issue, the theme of which is on authenticity, was I reported it in Shenzhen and Guangzhou in South China, and profiled a, she's my age, so she's 30 now, counterfeit impresario who... his parents are construction workers and who loves fashion and knows everything about every fashion designer ever and who worked her way up and is now driving around in a Maserati based on her counterfeit wholesale business and is very, very aware of how counterfeits are now, and bootlegs in general, are now sometimes considered, quote, cool by streetwear culture, yeah. And feels, is very sort of aware about her place in the fashion industry. And
she showed you around, didn't she?
Yeah, she showed me around, and she she's not just aware, she, I would say, is pretty self-important about her place in the fashion industry. Yeah, so she's a really interesting character. That's a great piece, which is in the current issue of Vest, the print issue of Vesto, which the piece is online, but I highly recommend buying the journal, which is at McNally Jackson.
We're gonna bring
Jackson.
One into the shop so that anybody who wants to come and read it here can come in.
Yeah, that would be good. It's a really beautiful physical product as well as a lot of great content. So that is So I'm all over the place. Those are all different things I'm doing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Alice.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
We have a playlist here, so you can kind of listen to what Alice listens to when she's maybe working, walking around, talking to people, or in between talking to people. And also so you can get a sense of what a fun, energetic, happy person she is. Thanks for being
sometimes.
Here.
Sometimes. I
yeah.
try.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
You make me happy.
Yay.